Thank you so much, Anna. Thank you so much for having me here. I would like to thank Anna and all of you for coming. And it's really a great pleasure and a privilege for me to give a talk at this seminar and to share my thought with you. So my paper will focus on Julian's letter to Themistius. Well, Julian's letter to Themistius is an extraordinary work that makes it possible to assess some interesting aspects of the philosophical debate during the 3rd century. The chronology of this letter is controversial. Well, in my view, it is a very likely hypothesis that the letter has to be dated to the early period of Julian's Caesarship, so around 355-356, whereas a later chronology is less plausible. Here I agree with the recent volume by Simon Swain on Julian's letter to Themistius, who in turn relies on a seminar article by Jean Bouffartic. Well, be that as it may, my reading will be little concerned with chronological issues. Well, in his letter, Julian reacts to an earlier letter by Themistius, which is unfortunately lost. We can, however, try to outline some features of Themistius' lost letter by drawing from Julian's response and from Themistius' discourses. There, Themistius often speaks in favor of his choice to engage in political life, a choice that others probably criticize as unworthy of a true philosopher. Certainly, Themistius had to face a number of opponents in the political and cultural environment at Constantinople. Some of his speeches, composed around 355, when Constantius appointed him as a senator, are extremely interesting from this point of view. These speeches make it possible to outline the background of his discussion with Julian. Well, Themistius replies to his opponents and does his best to show that his mode of life is genuinely philosophical. The issue at stake is therefore the definition of the philosophical life and the relation between philosophy and politics. According to Themistius, there is no position between philosophy and politics. More precisely, politics is the natural completion of philosophy, and philosophers should be engaged in politics. Otherwise, they will merely be philosophers in words. So Themistius repeatedly criticizes those philosophers who escape society and political life. This view is connected to Themistius' doctrine of the philosopher king. He regards kingship as connected with philosophy and superior to laws. So, the philosopher king is much more than a mere guardian of laws. Certainly, Themistius drew this theory from earlier Hellenistic and post-Hellenistic sources, for example Dio and some pseudo-Pythagorean treatises. But Themistius gave a distinctive emphasis to this view. So according to Themistius, the philanthropical king, such as Constantius, is an animate law and ranks above laws. So you have the first passage in your handout, which is taken from Themistius' famous discourse number one, and there you find this view. There are, of course, several parallels. The king is able to correct laws and can adapt them to concrete and particular situations. In so doing, the philosopher king is an image of divine rule over the world. Through his actions, he is able to imitate the ruling activity of God. In his encomium to Constantius, so the speech number two, in 355, Themistius refers to his own election to the Senate and finishes by congratulating Constantius on appointing a philosopher as a Caesar. In so doing, so the philosopher was of course Julian. In doing so, Constantius demonstrates, according to Themistius, that he is a true philosopher himself. What Constantius and Julian have in common is, according to Themistius, not so much their genus, but the fact that they are close in virtue. In his recent monograph on Julian and Themistius, Simon Swain has convincingly argued that Themistius' original letter to Julian was probably connected to this encomium. So in his letter, Themistius probably intended both to put forward a model of rulership to Julian and to congratulate him by telling how lucky he was. End of quote. So in his letter, in his last letter, probably Themistius invited Julian to follow this philosopher king model and compared his condition to that of Heracles and Dionysus, who were at the same time philosophers and kings. So you have text 2 in your handout. It is taken from Julian's reply to Themistius, and you can have this parallel there. So, as we can see from Julian's reply, i.e. from his letter to Themistius, Themistius was certainly wrong, was badly wrong, actually. And his encomium and his letter had probably everything to make Julian upset. And indeed, Julian's reply, his letter to Themistius, was far from being cordial. Well, it has been argued that after Julian's attack, Themistius replied with a letter which is now preserved in Arabic. There, Themistius aimed to find some sort of appeasement with Julian. Well, I will not go into this intricate issue. I will simply refer to some recent contributions by Swain and Watt on this controversial dossier. Certainly, the relation between Themistius and Julian were not close, let alone cordial, and this independently on whether Themistius withdrew from public life under Julian's rulership as Augustus. This is a controversial issue. I won't go into that. Well, that said, it is very interesting to delve into the exchange between Themistius and Julian, since it seems to me that their discussion reveals some key features of the philosophical debate during the first century. The issues at stake are the relation between philosophy and political engagement, and in connection to this, the very idea of philosophy and its relation to the normative texts of the tradition. Themistius had spoken in favor of a philosopher king who is fully engaged in political life. Julian rejects this model and expresses a number of reservations about the very idea of a philosopher king. This is the broad framework of the letter. First, in his letter, Julian carefully separates his own condition from that of a philosopher king. In this letter, as elsewhere, Julian claims that his philosophical training is not over yet. He loves philosophy, but does not possess it fully and completely. We will return to this issue later on. However, Julian raises further objections to Themistius' views about philosopher kings. His criticism includes a very interesting parallel between Socrates and Alexander the Great, a parallel that Julian develops by arguing in favor of the superiority of Socrates. True, Socrates was not anybody's master, but his works rank over those of Alexander, for Socrates saved many lives through philosophy. Furthermore, Julian refers to Plato's laws and argues in favor of the primacy of the laws, so the ruler is a guardian of the laws and remains subordinated to them. That's text number 3 in your handout. We'll come back to this text in a few minutes. So then Julian argues that Aristotle does not claim that philosophy and political life should be unified. Rather, according to Julian, Aristotle regards philosophy as superior to political life. So Themistius was an authoritative exegete of Aristotle, and it is very interesting that Julian basically claims that Themistius' reading of Aristotle is not correct. This is what he says in this letter. Of course, we should not think of a direct attack on Themistius. All is done according to the conventions of this debate. We should not think that Julian is insulting Themistius or something like that. The letter is written according to all rhetorical codes, but still, this disagreement is perceptible, is extremely clearly perceptible in what Julian writes. So here, I cannot focus on Julian's arguments in detail. I will limit myself to some remarks. As noted earlier, the letter includes a profession of modesty. Julian distinguishes his condition from that of a genuine philosopher, so he claims that his own nature is not special at all. He loves philosophy, but practical vicissitudes have prevented that love from being fulfilled. It's text number two. So Julian cannot be a true philosopher king for the very simple fact that he is no accomplished philosopher at all. Well, this is not an isolated passage. Often, in his works, Julian distinguishes his own condition from that of an accomplished philosopher. As a matter of fact, however, these professions of modesty have a complex meaning and should probably not be taken at face value, or at least not without further qualification. As to the letter to Themistius, it is very important, in my view, to notice that Julian actually does his best to show that he knows philosophy very well. The letter includes allusions to the whole Greek philosophical tradition. As noted by Jean Bouffartigue, la lettre est une sorte de lieu de rendez-vous pour tous ceux qui comptent en philosophie dans la Grèce du 6e au 3e siècle de notre ère. Ils sont convoqués Platon, Aristote, Chrysippe et l'estoïcisme, mais aussi Épicure, ainsi que des présocratiques comme Pythagore, Anaxagore et Démocrite, et encore Socrate et un certain nombre de Socratiques, dont Antisthène et enfin Diogène. So, the whole of Greek philosophy is, in a way, present in this letter. What is more, Julian does his best to show that he knows Plato and Aristotle better than Themistius does. The letter, then, has both an overt and an implicit message. According to its overt and prima facie content, Julian cannot be a philosopher king, that's what he claims, because he is no accomplished philosopher. According to its implicit content, Julian is attempting to show that he is actually a much better philosopher than Themistius, and that is the reason why he rejects Themistius' view about the relation between philosophy and rulership. As we shall see, in so doing, Julian discreetly suggests that Themistius' views about philosophy and politics are actually based on a wrong conception of philosophy. It is also interesting to notice that Julian and Themistius agree on some issues. For example, both of them reject Epicurus' idea of living unnoticed. In his speeches, Themistius often criticizes Epicurus' precept and contrasts it with the naturally social character of human beings. Julian shares this view insofar as he carefully distinguishes his own position from the Epicurean one. He claims not to be suggesting that one should pursue a contemplative life that eschews political engagement. That said, politics is not for everyone, and Julian refers to Socrates' efforts to keep Glaucon and Alcibiades apart from politics. As noted earlier, Socrates is Julian's positive hero in his letter to Themistius, and Socrates' negative counterpart here is Alexander the Great. In a short section devoted to the Stoics, Julian criticizes Chrysippus for neglecting the importance of fortune and luck and other such factors that fall in the way of men of action outside of their control. These aspects make the pursuit of politics uncertain. I shall come back later to this section. Now, I will briefly outline Julian's discussion of Plato and Aristotle. There is really a rich literature on the letter and on these passages. I cannot discuss this literature in full. Possibly we come back on some of those issues during the discussion. Well, two passages from Plato's Laws, from Plato's Laws Book 4, show, according to Julian, the impact of fortune and accidental events on human vicissitudes. Therefore, rulership over this world has some intrinsic limits that cannot be abolished. Only a divine king, that's text number 3 in your handout, such as Cronus, could stop this situation. He was aware of the weaknesses of human beings and therefore he appointed as the rulers of cities creatures superior to human beings, i.e. demons. Where the rulers are instead mortal beings, the only solution to escape evil is to imitate the way of life of Cronus times so as to rely on the element of immortality within us, terming the distribution of reason law. End of quote. In short, the only way to rectify our present condition, at least as far as this is possible, resides in relying on the law. And law is seen as a sort of ruling principle in Julian's letter. So, as noted by Domenico Mara in his monograph on Neoplatonism and Politics, in his letter to Themistius, Julian does not follow Plato's political model in the Republic, but rather that in the laws. So Julian regards rulership based on laws as the best possible approximation to an ideal government as far as this can be realized in our imperfect world, where fortune cannot be abolished and makes human activity uncertain. So, the best ruler is no philosopher king, a la Themistius, but a mere guardian of the laws. So, Julian's respectful animosity, these are words, this is how Van der Spel describes Julian's letter, so as characterized by respectful animosity. So, this feature fully emerges in the section on Aristotle. As noted earlier, in this part of the letter, Julian engages in a true competition with Themistius, whose authority as an exegete of Aristotle Julian overtly recognizes, just before showing that Themistius' reading of Aristotle's Politics is wrong. Drawing on Politics Book 3, Julian rejects the idea that dynastic monarchy is the best kind of government and repeats his view that the ruler is nothing but a guardian of the laws. Furthermore, and that's text number 4 in your handout, Julian criticizes the reading of Politics Book 7, Chapter 3, probably developed by Themistius in his previous letter. Against Themistius, Julian reads Aristotle's passage as showing that the contemplative life ranks over the active life. Hence, the architects of noble actions mentioned by Aristotle are not kings, as suggested by Themistius, but lawgivers and political philosophers, i.e., anybody who acts by virtue of their intellect and reason, not those who physically undertake and execute the business of politics. End of quote. So I would conclude my survey by focusing on Julian's treatment of Socrates. Socrates is a crucial figure for both Themistius and Julian, but they regard Socrates' model in different ways. So according to Themistius, Socrates' figure shows that philosophy and political engagement must be unified. According to Julian, instead, Socrates shows the superiority of the contemplative life. Therefore, Socrates is superior to Alexander, who did not manage to make anybody wiser through his enterprises. That's text number 5. We read this text now. But all those who are now being saved through philosophy are being saved through Socrates. It is not I alone who think this. Aristotle seems to have thought of saying it first when he noted that he had a right to be no less proud of his work on theology, Epite Theologicae Sum Graphe, it's a curious reference, than the man who destroyed the Persian Empire. So here I will end my survey of Julian's letter and try to read this work against the wider background of first century philosophical debate. So I will now come to the proper topic of this paper. I will emerge from this paper. I'm inclined to resist a, so to say, autobiographical or psychological reading of Julian's letter to Themistius. It is quite possible to read the letter from this perspective, but I think it's possibly more fruitful to read this letter as related to a broader debate, which in a sense transcends Julian's individual psychology or whatever we can say about his attitude to power and so on. So it is worth noting that Julian and Themistius have much in common. And this despite their disagreement. In particular, they both share a canon of normative texts and develop their thought by interpreting their authorities. What separates Julian and Themistius is not their canon of authorities, which is common, but rather the way in which they rely on the same normative text. It is extremely interesting to focus on Themistius' famous speech number 20, i.e. the epitaphium for his father Eugenius. There, Themistius describes his father's attitude to philosophy in a way that actually adumbrates Themistius' own attitude to philosophy. And this epitaphium has aptly been described as a kind of self-advertisement. So it's text number 6. I will now read the whole of this very interesting passage. So it's Themistius talking about his father. To be sure, the visage and shape impressed upon these sacred mysteries were almost entirely those of Aristotle. Nevertheless, my father helped to open up all the shrines of the sages. He was one of those who were fully initiated in the sacred knowledge that Pythagoras of Samos brought back to Greece from Egypt, and what Zeno of Citium later taught in the painted Stoa. He always displayed the works of the great Plato right at the door and in the very temple present. When passing to the academy from the Lyceum, he did not change his clothes. He would often first make a sacrifice to Aristotle and then end by worshipping Plato. It's a wonderful passage. The traditional interpretation of Themistius as an Aristotelian and anti-Platonic philosopher has not much to commend itself. I think that Richard already talked about this issue. And this passage aptly shows that Themistius actually shares a crucial idea of New Platonic philosophers, i.e. the harmony between Plato and Aristotle, where Plato's philosophy is seen as crowning the philosophical curriculum. Pythagoras is also included in the canon of normative authors, and so are the Stoics. Finally, Themistius makes use of the vocabulary pertaining to the celebration of mysteries in order to express the agreement of Plato and Aristotle. Celebrating the Aristotelian mysteries is seen as a propedeutic to the celebration of the Platonic ones. Well, all this is well-known material to those who are familiar with the New Platonic exegesis. And from this perspective, the Themistius canon of authorities could well be shared by a disciple of Iamblichus, such as Julian, to be more precise, Julian was an indirect disciple of Iamblichus, since his philosophical training came from the so-called school of Pergamon, established by Odysseus, who had in turn been a student of Iamblichus. And indeed, scholars have aptly remarked that Themistius' canon of philosophical authorities, as emerged from this speech, is more or less the same as Julian's canon of authorities, as this emerged, for example, from his letter 89b to Theodorus. It's a famous passage, it's text number 7 in your handout. Well, that said, some further remarks are called for. The fact that Julian and Themistius share a canon of normative texts and argue in favor of a harmonizing reading of Plato and Aristotle does not entail that their positions are identical. It seems to me a crucial aspect of early Neoplatonic philosophical debate that the same canon of authorities could be interpreted in very different ways. As for Themistius' passage, two remarks are important in my view. First, Themistius' vocabulary of the mysteries does not point to any Iamblichian or specially religious reading of the theurgical reading of the philosophical tradition, and after all, is nothing but a well-known Platonic reminiscence from Plato's Symposium. Secondly, while Pythagoras is included in Themistius' canon of normative philosophers, He has certainly no eminent position, and Themistius does not argue in favor of a Pythagorizing reading of the Greek philosophical tradition. I will come back to this issue in a moment. Finally, Themistius does not mention the Chaldean oracles and theurgy at all. In sum, his harmonizing reading of Greek philosophy leaves aside two crucial features of Iamblichus' distinctive exegetical method, i.e., the Pythagorean reading of Plato and Aristotle and the role played by theurgy and Chaldean oracles. In a way, Themistius' position is closer to Porphyry than to Iamblichus, although further research is needed to prove a distinctive Porphyrian inspiration in Themistius' philosophical works. For the time being, it is sufficient to note that Themistius' philosophical stance does not prove to be Aristotelian rather than Platonic or Neoplatonic. Rather, Themistius offers a peculiar harmonizing reading of the Greek philosophical tradition that shares many features with that of Iamblichus, but differs from it in some respects. This conclusion is further confirmed by two very interesting pieces of evidence. The first is well known, it's text number 8 in your handout. As Boethius reports, Themistius regarded Archytas' treatise on the categories as spurious and argued that the author was not Pythagorean at all, but some peripatetic Archytas who found authority for a new work on the basis of an ancient name. This is a very important piece of evidence, and I think we should be well aware of its anti-Iamblichian implications. By regarding Archytas' work as spurious, Themistius actually removes the main support to Iamblichus' Pythagorean and metaphysical reading of Aristotle's categories. Famously, Iamblichus held that Aristotle had derived his theory from Archytas. So therefore, Themistius' remark seems to be inspired not by any kind of philological scruple, but rather by philosophical polemics. And the very interesting passage from Themistius' speech number 23 confirms his hostile attitude to Iamblichus. There, Themistius reports, text number 9. There, Themistius reports that a man from Sicyon had originally been a disciple of the man of Chalcis, i.e. of Iamblichus, when the latter was elderly. He was, however, not a devotee of the new song, i.e., as Penella suggests, and I think he's right, he was not a devotee of a new kind of theurgical philosophy established by Iamblichus, but of the ancestral and ancient song of the Academy and the Lyceum. So when this man discovered Themistius' works, he completely changed his allegiance. So he and his student moved to Constantinople and became disciples of Themistius. With his usual taste for self-advertisement, Themistius compares the philosophical conversion of this man to the philosophical conversions of Zeno and Axiotea. Again, it is very interesting that Themistius describes his own philosophical method as the ancestral and ancient song of the Academy and the Lyceum. So, basically, Themistius presents himself as the genuine follower of the old tradition established by Plato and Aristotle, while Iamblichus is criticized for his innovations. Building on these conclusions, we can now come back to Julian. His difference from Themistius is clear and resides in Julian's peculiar support to some distinctive aspects of Iamblichian Platonism, in particular his attitude to theurgy and Chaldean oracles. A passage from Julian's discourse to the Mother of the Gods is particularly telling from this point of view. Julian is there criticizing the position of the peripatetic philosopher Xenarchus, and in connection to this criticism, he describes his own attitude to the philosophical tradition. That's text number 10 in your handout. So let me read this text. Now, whether what he, i.e. Xenarchus, says is correct or not, let us leave to the extreme peripatetics to refine upon. But that his view is not agreeable to me is, I think, clear to everyone, for I hold that the theories of Aristotle himself are incomplete unless they are brought into harmony with those of Plato, or rather, we must make this also agree with the oracles that have been vouchsafed to us by the gods. Well, in a few words, this is Iamblichus' philosophical program. This program does not remove the study of Aristotle at all, quite the contrary. By the way, Julian was well familiar with Aristotle. We know that Julian was familiar with Aristotle and he was the arbiter in a dispute that opposed Themistius and Maximus of Ephesus concerning Aristotle's syllogistic. So these aspects of Julian's philosophical method should in no way be underestimated. Still, according to Julian, Aristotle is clearly subordinated to Plato, and both of them are subordinated to the supernatural teaching of the Chaldean oracles. According to Themistius, teaching philosophy is no elitist practice, for everybody can benefit from philosophy independently of his training and social provenance. Julian, instead, emphasizes that philosophy is not for everybody, and according to the tradition of Pythagoras and Iamblichus, he sees the most profound teachings of philosophy as reserved for the highest natures. So, as noted earlier, it would be certainly wrong to simply oppose Julian and Themistius. Much of their philosophical program is simply identical, and is based on an interpretation of the normative text of the Greek philosophical tradition. Unlike Themistius, Julian holds that philosophical exegesis is incomplete unless it is supplemented by the superior revelation granted by the Chaldean oracles. This is a crucial difference. So Julian here is a follower of Iamblichus, or rather a follower of a certain current within Iamblichus' school, i.e. that represented by Maximus of Ephesus, Julian's venerated master of philosophy and theurgy. As a matter of fact, however, not all Iamblichian philosophers shared Maximus and Julian's enthusiasm for theurgy. We know from Eunapius that Eusebius, one of Egidius' students, did not share Maximus' enthusiasm for theurgy at all. So even within the so-called school of Pergamum, there was a certain part of reservation towards theurgy. And there is a very important text. It is at the very end of your handout. I have no time to discuss it in my paper. Possibly we will come back to this text during the discussion, i.e. Julian's letter 12, Bides, to the philosopher Priscus. Well, this letter shows that there were followers of Theodorus of Asine in Athens who discredited Iamblichus. Note that this Theodorus had probably been a student of Iamblichus, but again, he did not share some of his views about the soul and its purification through theurgy.
But you want to refer to the passage?
No, not really. I just refer to this passage, which shows that there was a certain debate among the disciples of Iamblichus. So people sometimes assume that after Iamblichus, all of those guys immediately became enthusiasts for theurgy, and Julian was enthusiast for theurgy because all people around him were enthusiasts for theurgy. This is actually not the case. There were discussions about Iamblichus' position, and Julian chooses to adopt one of several possible options in the philosophical debate, in the philosophical and cultural debate around him. That's my main point, and this letter is very interesting because it shows that Julian is willing to make a choice. He says, well, my authorities are Iamblichus and the Chaldean oracles and Priscus, one of the members of the Pergamon school, whereas Julian rejects Porphyry and Theodorus. So this letter is very interesting from this point of view because it's a crucial document of those debates in the early part of the 4th century AD. I can possibly go on. So the very important thing is that this Theodorus had probably been a student of Iamblichus, but again, he did not share some of his views about the soul and its purification through theurgy. So Themistius was definitely not alone in his anti-theurgical approach, and apparently Iamblichus' innovations were at least initially not received with unanimous approval, even by those philosophers who were connected to Iamblichus and his school. So I would suggest then that it is misleading to assess Iamblichus' immediate posterity by drawing on what happened in Athens' Neoplatonic school one century later. Apparently, so the school of Syrianus, Proclus, and so on. Apparently, at the beginning, Iamblichus' Pythagorean and theurgical reading of the philosophical tradition was not accepted unanimously. So Julian should not only be seen as a disciple of Iamblichus. Rather, he chooses to follow a well-defined line of Iamblichus' legacy, i.e. that of theurgical philosophy represented by Maximus and Priscus. Those who were with Julian when he died, by the way. So I would suggest that some work has still to be done in order to assess the philosophical debates around Iamblichus and before the first century. The fifth century. The situation is more complex than scholars sometimes assume. Well, I now come back to the very last part of my paper, which deals on with text number 11, so this series of passages in your handout. It's a very difficult passage from Julian's letter to Themistius. As noted earlier, Julian criticized the Stoics because they do not consider how Tuche affects human agency. So happiness can hardly be sure and stable if it depends on fortune. Some difficult lines follow these remarks. You have the Greek in your handout. I won't read the Greek. I will now read Simon Swain's translation of these lines. Thank you very much. So we are now to reading text number 11. So these lines from a letter, Julian's letter. That's Swain's translation. The assurance of happiness is very unlikely to depend on fortune. Yet, men who live a public life cannot breathe without air, i.e. without fortune, as the saying goes, unless one is going to assert, like people who study the form truthfully, or who place them falsely among things incorporeal and intelligible, that the king and commander is located far above matters of chance. There is a textual problem with these lines, which has been tackled by Bidez, and basically all people think that Bidez has solved the problems. Because afterward Basilea, the manuscript B, has a passage from Julian's letter to Theodorus, which ends, as Bidez shows, before the words Kai Strategon. At first sight, this is a somewhat disconcerting passage. Since Julian mentions the view that forms are incorporeal and intelligible and says that this view is false. Or rather, Julian apparently in this passage opposes those who truthfully study the forms and those who wrongly place the forms among incorporeal and intelligible things. This is a current translation and one that obviously raises some problems. This is how Augusto Rostagni explained this passage in his old but still valuable work on Julian. So there is some Italian now. Pare che questo inciso non sia stato fin qui compreso dai traduttori. È evidente che l'autore, Giuliano, nello scrivere a Temistio, seguace di Aristotele, non vuole dare senz'altro come vera la dottrina platonica secondo cui le idee appartengono al mondo incorporeo ed intellegibile, ma ammette anche la possibilità della critica aristotelica, secondo la quale l'idea non esiste che nella cosa. End of quote. By the way, Rostagni is one of the very rare interpreters who focus on those lines, which are usually neglected. So according to Rostagni, and several interpreters follow this reading, Julian would be making some concession to Themistius. Themistius was a peripatetic philosopher, according to Rostagni. Of course, Rostagni's work is very old. It was not aware of what we are aware of about Themistius. So Themistius was a peripatetic philosopher. Julian would be making some concession to him, thus granting that the forms are not separate but immanent in things. Well, this hypothesis is implausible. First, it is not clear at all that Themistius rejected Plato's ideas, and as noted earlier, it is simply wrong to regard him as an anti-Platonist Aristotelian. Secondly, it is simply unthinkable that Julian would make such a concession in his letter. Julian is not inclined to make concessions in this letter, and it is really unthinkable that he would make such a strong concession to an opponent of his views. But it is possible, however, that these lines have a different meaning. It is interesting to note at first the use of the participle syntithentes. So you have pseudos syntithentes. This verb can hardly mean to place, to situate, as, for example, place, Swain renders this verb, as usually suggested. As a matter of fact, syntithemi usually denotes the act of composing, a synthesis, rather than the act of placing or locating something. And it is, most of all, a common term in the philosophical vocabulary, where it denotes the dialectical procedures through which thought composes and combines its contents so as to draw inferences. You have a passage from Plotinus' treatise on dialectic, where you have this occurrence of syntithentes. Let me read this passage briefly. So intellect gives clear principle to any soul which can receive them, and then it combines and interweaves and distinguishes their consequences till it arrives at perfect intelligence. So syntithentes rather means combining rather than placing. If this is correct, I would suggest that Julian is actually opposing those who truthfully contemplate the forms and those who falsely compose forms by making discursive judgments on them, hence jeopardizing their perfect simplicity. In short, in these lines, Julian contrasts two ways of grasping the ideas. According to the true and higher method, ideas are a pure object of contemplation. According to the lower method, forms are expressed through discursive judgments. This inferior way of grasping the forms is false if compared to the first one. However, even, and see Julian's use of chi in these lines, even those who grasp the forms in this inferior way are above fortune. Those who instead do not grasp separate forms at all, either truly or discursively, are subject to fortune and hazard. So if this is correct, I would suggest that this sentence should be construed in a way different from that usually proposed. I would take the word en tois asomatois, kainoitois, as being connected to both participles, i.e. to both theoruntes and syntithentes. And I would take the accusative tas ideas as the object of both verbs. So, I will suggest another translation, i.e. the following one, like people who, in intelligible and incorporeal things, either truthfully study the forms, or even chi, which the traditional interpretation leaves unexplained, or even falsely compose them. And I should add that Asmus, in his old German translation of Julian, had already correctly construed these lines, although his rendering of syntithentes is inadequate. So, welche Ideen im Reiche des Unkörperlichen und Intelligibel entweder wahrhaft schauen oder auch nur fälschlich erdichten. So, in a recent monograph on Neoplatonism and Politics, Michael Schramm develops an interesting interpretation of this passage and connects Julian's statement with the Neoplatonic theory of levels of virtue, i.e. with the distinction between cathartic and contemplative virtues, as well as with the distinction between discursive thinking and pure contemplative thought. So what Julian is describing here is a genuine Platonic ruler who either grasps the pure contemplative life of intellect, or, even if he cannot attain pure contemplation, is at least able to approach this goal by composing the forms in discursive judgments through his reason. So such a ruler would possess either the contemplative or the cathartic virtues and would therefore be free from the external aversions caused by fortune. As noted by Schramm, Julian thus accepts the Stoic view that the wise man is happy insofar as he has virtue, while at the same time transposing this view into his Platonic ideal of life, which culminates in the contemplation of intelligible beings. Practical life can attain this perfect happiness. I would also remark, so in addition to what Michael Schramm says, I would remark that in his letter to Themistius, Julian does not regard this favorable situation as attainable in reality. If such a perfectly virtuous ruler existed, it would be such as the man Diogenes says is without the city, without the home, bereft of his homeland. End of quote. So basically, in his letter, Julian distinguishes between those who can attain the superior knowledge of intelligible beings, either through intuition or through discursive thought, but are thus foreign to politics, and those who are engaged in practical life and are thus subject to fortune and hazard. Well, this is the well-known general view of Julian's letter that opposes contemplative life and argues in favor, that opposes contemplative and active life and argues in favor of the first one. So I would end my paper with some supplementary remarks on these issues. Asmus has interestingly observed that Julian's subsequent work, and in particular his discourse number 7, where he sets out a complex autobiographical myth, can be seen as a positive counterpart to Julian's letter to Themistius. It is actually a well-known fact that Julian's hesitations are much less prominent in the speeches composed during his rulership as Augustus. There, Julian appears to be fully aware that he is a ruler chosen by the gods, and this is not the case with Julian's letter to Themistius. So whereas in the letter to Themistius, Julian distinguishes his own condition from that of philosopher kings, such as Heracles or Dionysus, this distinction is much less evident in his later works. That said, there is no need to see a contradiction between the letter to Themistius and Julian's later works. I would rather suggest that the letter is the pars destruens of Julian's project, whereas his later works represent the pars construens of his overall view. In the letter, Julian aims to show that a certain view of the relation between philosophy and politics, i.e. that of Themistius, is wrong. For Themistius fails to grasp the genuinely divine character of philosophy that is grounded on the contemplation of superior beings. Themistius downplays philosophy and thus makes it part of human praxis. Julian clearly argues that contemplation ranks over this sort of philosophy. So, theoretic philosophy should be chosen instead of politics. I would gloss Julian's view in this way. If we stick to Themistius' account of philosophy and politics, then genuine philosophy should be set apart from politics. And that's what he says in his letter. This is the sense of his polemics against Themistius. But this is only half of Julian's view, for he also thinks that the genuine philosophy inspired by the gods is what can ground an effective political activity. As is shown by Julian's later works and by Julian's activity as emperor, he actually aim to unify philosophy and political activity, but in a way that was inverse to that proposed by Themistius. Thank you.